Campus 103.7, Campus 103.7, Minainain Baranin, Malta through international eyes. In today's edition, I'm Colin Fitz, by the way, I have a guest. His name is Martin Atsopardi. He's Maltese, but he lived in the United Kingdom for 30 years and has travelled widely. And he has a very exciting and interesting story to tell. And we're going to do the program in English because I know that the program is listened to by a lot of people from all over the world. So I think it's best that we stick to English, even though Martin can't speak Maltese perfectly well. But Martin Atsopardi, thank you for joining me on this edition of Minainain Baranin, Malta Through International Eyes.
Yes, thank you very much for asking me to meet with you and to speak about myself.
Now, you're not a foreigner, but you do have international eyes, I think, because you've travelled widely and you lived away from Malta for 30 years. And that's the perspective I want to explore in this programme.
Okay, yes. I mean, although I've now spent more time in Malta than I did abroad, because of my age, but I still consider myself quite British because I think my formative years were there, as in my working career was there, and so I think of myself as quite English. However, I am Maltese and I do blend in with the Malta life.
Absolutely. And you have a very active life, which we will talk about a bit later on, particularly on the cultural scene. But let's start off with perhaps even your ancestors rather than your childhood, which we will talk about. Because in preparation for this program, in doing some research and a chat with you, it turns out that, for example, you have a connection to Gibraltar.
Yep.
So could you tell us a little bit about maybe your grandparents and then down the generations?
Okay, so on my mother's side, on my maternal side, my grandfather worked for British American Tobacco and found the job, and he had placement first in Kenya.
Maltese, yes?
He was Maltese. Mm-hmm. His surname was Audibert, which is a French name. However, they were Maltese. Mm-hmm. Looking at their ancestors, from the knights, they were on the French side. That's how it came down when we looked up the family tree.
So there's been a presence in Malta
since then.
Since then.
Yes. And he worked for British American Tobacco and went to Kenya. Came back to Malta, married my grandmother, and then started having several kids.
And this is around the time of the end of the 19th century?
He was 1880, this is 1890.
Yes.
I mean, my mother was born in 1915, and she was born in Gibraltar. Mm. And they were there for quite a few years before and after. I think when they came back to Malta, my mother must have been about 12, so we're talking about 1927. And immediately, my grandfather came back to work for British American Tobacco. The offices were in Valletta at the time. Now, he was quite a social person. He liked to smoke a lot because I think part of his salary was cigarettes and liked to drink a lot. when they came back to Malta with my mother and her sisters, and they all spoke Spanish, to keep their friends around here not understanding what they're saying.
Okay. Obviously, they spoke English as
They spoke English.
But they learned Spanish in...
They learned Spanish in Gibraltar because they went to school there. Mm. And they obviously taught them Spanish. And in fact, my aunt and my mother, as they grew older, always spoke Spanish together, mm-hmm. so we wouldn't understand them, because obviously we understood English, we understood Maltese, we understood Italian, so they gave up, so they went on to Spanish as they gossiped about people, so for us not to understand.
But would people sort of take it against them?
That No. They just looked at them and said, Spagnoli type thing, because obviously their sense of fashion was slightly different to what the Malta was at the time.
Yeah.
So that's... how a connection to Gibraltar is, although her parents were Maltese. However, she was born in a British colony. And in 1964, My father had to decide for my mother whether she'd remain British or become Maltese. She didn't make the decision. Her husband made the decision for her.
So in those days, it was still...
It was still like that.
Like that.
And obviously, my father told her, well, you're not going to England, so you might as well become Maltese. And she became Maltese, which we all hated for, because if she had a British passport, it would have given us sort of carte blanche to be able to leave Malta and go to England at that time. Because when I went to England... Which was in 1974, after I had finished studying. I'd finished school in 1972, 2 years at MCOS doing a business management course. Then when I finished, during that time, I was working in a hotel as work experience, which had to be part of what I was doing and I was doing my studies.
Now, so this is late 60s, early 70s?
No, this is 72, 74. 74.
And there weren't that many hotels in Malta. The tourist boom hadn't really
happened yet. But they were.
There were a few.
There were a few. And as it happened, my cousin was married to somebody who worked as the manager.
Okay.
So I got a job. First, I started just as a cashier in the restaurants. Uh-huh. And then from there, I went to reception and I was doing a bit of thing. So when I finished and passed my course, I then went to London in June 1974.
Since you were Maltese, you didn't have a British passport.
No.
But you were allowed to go and live and work in the UK. How did it work?
No, you weren't. You were not.
I see.
So how I went is I went on holiday, technically.
Yes.
And then my father posted to me all my certificates, all that sort of thing. So I didn't take them with me just in case I get stopped going in.
In customs, yes.
Yes. Anyway, so at the time, I spoke a few languages, as we all did in those days. And because I had hotel experience, I was looking up in those days, the Evening Standard, looking for jobs.
The newspaper.
And which is a newspaper.
Yes.
It came out. And there was a job in a hotel, which was Grosvenor House Hotel on Park Lane.
Oh.
Which is a 5-star hotel.
Absolutely.
And I thought, oh, that will do me. So I went for the interview and, you know, they realized I spoke a few languages. And so I got the job.
But now, didn't the fact that you didn't have a work permit?
Well, how did
it work in those days?
I sort of said a little white lie. I said, oh, of course I've got a permit. Of course I've got a student permit. That's what I said. Then a few months later, I said, oh, sorry, but my student permit is only for 6 months. By that time, my boss liked me.
Uh-huh.
And then they applied for my permit, and I got it.
And you got a permit as an alien, but illegal alien.
Exactly. But then I had to remain with the company, which was Strauss House 40 at the time, for 5 years.
Okay.
But the funny thing is, I'm just going to go back, when I was offered the job, I remember it was the 70s, I had big sort of sideboards, barbetti down, and my hair was all cut in a most terrible fashion, probably.
This was the glam era, wasn't it?
Of course. Yes. And they told me, well, you have to cut your hair and shave your sideboards. And I said, okay, I'll do that. So in those days, obviously no telephones or nothing, I wrote a letter to my parents telling them that. And immediately I got a letter back from my father saying, they managed to do something in a minute that I've been trying for years. So...
oh, cool. I'd just like to linger a little bit on this point, because up till the 60s, Maltese were allowed to go to the UK as part of the empire,
I think before...
Without having to have a work permit.
Before the independence.
Before independence.
Yes.
After independence, you couldn't just go and get a job in the UK.
Not, I don't think so, because obviously that's what I couldn't in the
it
early 70s.
It became a bit more complicated.
It became you had to be apply for a job or and you had to get a permit.
Yes, unless you had a British grandparent.
Exactly, then you could work on that.
That would work with that, and that give you a permit. And then eventually the EU thing came about, where for a number of years, when Malta joined the European Union and Britain had been a part of the EU since the 70s,
then
Maltese people could go and work in the UK normally until Brexit happened in 2016. And now we're back to square one, pretty much.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
I'm talking about this, but I know a lot of Maltese immigrated to the UK, and some of them went before 64 and they had no problem. Some of them went in the period that you went and had to wheel and deal until they managed to get permission to stay. And I, for example, was married to a British girl, and that's how I was allowed to stay and work in the UK a few years before 2004 when we joined the EU.
Yeah.
But for the sake of our listeners who might not know the ins and outs.
I had contemporaries of the time who tried to go to the UK.
Yes.
Like me.
Yes.
But they went as savvy as I was, they took papers with them. And so when they stopped them...
At customs.
And they said, why are you travelling with your education certificate? And why are you travelling with your birth certificate? And what do you explain? Going on holiday with that, you don't. So they
send them back.
So,
yes.
So anyway, I was a bit wiser.
Of course. Now, why would someone like you decide he wanted to go to the UK? Was it the reason it was the land of adventure and Malta was perhaps not offering so many opportunities? Or were there other reasons?
There was a combination of reasons. I think in the early 70s, maybe politically, Malta wasn't as stable as it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I was discovering my sexuality, I think.
Okay.
And as in... I thought, what am I going to do being gay in Malta in the early 70s? Felt, it wasn't the right. And I thought, my school friends, are they going to find out and all that sort of thing? So I thought the best thing is to escape. I had also sort of gone to sort of a gay bar in Malta. And a lot of them went people that I could really have been friends with.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what am I going to do? I'm going to be all lonely on my own here. Yes. So I thought, let's go to England and see what happens.
Now, England, it was still illegal.
No.
No, it had been changed, but only a few years before.
Yes, even in Malta. In Malta, it was in the early 70s that it became.
Yeah.
But in England, it was in the late 60s.
Yes.
But again, remember, it was 21, and I was still 19.
Ah, the legal age.
Yes. I mean, I left Malta when I was just 19.
Gosh.
So I was very young.
But I'm not saying that... what I'm saying is... Malta was still very conservative in those days, so it must have been hard to be gay here.
Yes, I mean, I think it's still always very hard to come out to yourself first. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I say. Mm-hmm. No matter what, even today, individual young people who are discovering their sexuality find it hard to come out to themselves before they come out to other people, because you are in a world with, most people are normal, straight, and that's how you are...
exposed to the world.
Exactly.
Yes.
So when you start thinking something's different about yourself, you obviously keep it to yourself first till you manage. So it's there. Yes, it might be easier when the people...
There's more support nowadays.
Exactly. And also it's more out.
Mm-hmm.
People, I mean, television, there's all... Everybody
indeed
is thing. Before, nobody was.
No.
So it was very different. People at my age see such a big difference now with marriage and, equal rights and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And people now, same sex, can adopt children. Mm-hmm. These are the sort of things that I missed out on.
Of course, when you were younger, yes.
Younger. A
relatively new phenomenon.
Of course. So, if I had to start all over again,
yes,
I would... do things differently.
Because when you went to the UK, although there was a bigger gay population that you could mingle with...
And it was London, so...
And friends, and London was always a bit more avant-garde than...
I mean, everybody in the UK went to London for...
Yes, but still there were restrictions.
Of course.
And possibly humiliations or attacks.
No. I mean, again, at the beginning when I started working...
Yes.
I mean, I didn't... ever outwardly say I'm gay, never. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's only in the recent years that I feel confident enough to say it.
Yes.
So, if somebody asked me, I confirmed.
Yes.
But I never sort of went in with a waving a rainbow flag, if it had existed then or not. But you know what I mean? I was just...
But not to dwell too much on this aspect of the interview, but it's interesting. However, you arrived in the UK at just the time when suddenly you started seeing David Bowie on television wearing makeup.
Yeah.
A man wearing makeup, more wearing women's clothes. And then the New Romantic period came and Boy George and Mark Almond. And slowly, slowly it became more mainstream and more accepted. And you lived through that.
I lived through
that. Must have been, if not empowering, encouraging.
No, of course, I lived in London through a time where it was very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we lived through the IRA bombs, you know, all that sort of thing. But, you know, we lived through, you know, these people living round the corner from us, practically, you know, and walking down going onto the King's Road in the 70s on a Saturday was amazing.
Tell me
because the first Saturday of every month, all the classic cars would drive up and down the King's Road.
Oh.
With all the famous people posing in them, and this was...
In those days, it would be the vintage cars, I would think, right? Because what's classic today?
Okay. But they were old.
A Ford Capri from the 70s is classic perhaps today, but in those days, it was a new car and probably not even appreciated. But the vintage cars. But also, you know, you'd have all sorts of artists and musicians, and the King's Road was very famous.
It was. And it's still, to me... A heart of a road that is very... I love it. Every time I go to London, I have to go to the King's Road. And I always lived in sort of the central London.
Uh-huh.
So I was always very close. I mean, I went shopping at Waitrose on the King's Road for many years. You know, so, you know, you'd be paying your thing and you'd see somebody quite famous...
Indeed.
In the queue, because they lived around there.
Absolutely.
I mean, Margaret Thatcher also lived.
Did she?
She just lived off the King's Road.
Well, wasn't Vivienne Westwood's boutique in Road and Malcolm McLaren and people who came up with
Vivienne Westwood had the first punk shop.
Yes, with a very provocative name.
She had another shop, which was at the end of the King's Road, so going to the new King's Road on the sort of corner bit, which had a clock, big clock outside, that used to sort of go clockwise, just go anti-clockwise, and was just going like that.
Oh.
Just going round and round and round and round, and the most unusual row of shops they were there, and hers was obviously the most unusual.
But so. as somebody who had come from Malta, did you fit in very easily into this life? Or were there any difficulties?
Okay, so when I first worked at Grosvenor House, I worked in front office cashier. So we had to wear a morning suit in the morning and a dinner suit in the evening.
So with tails?
Tails, bow ties, everything. I mean, in the morning with a thing. All very, very smart. And at Grosvenor House, we had a lot of famous people. They have the hotel and they had flats where very famous people lived there, like the Duchess of Argyll, you know, a lot of, I suppose, infamous people, you know, and film stars lived there. So they all, and also a lot of the people, when they visited the hotel, since I was in the cashier's department, so they would want their traveler's checks, if anybody knows traveler's check, cashed. And obviously, because they were famous, they wouldn't come down to the front office. So we, as the staff that we work there, would take it in turns to go to all these people.
In their rooms?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I saw quite a lot of famous people signing their checks, so it was great fun to see that, and they would, a lot of them, like Sammy Davis Jr., performed at Grosvenor House, and saw him, and I went up and I spoke to him.
Wow,
you know, there were others, so it was an amazing place to work. Also, the my colleagues there. Most, I think, that we were quite a few girls and a couple of guys, and we all got on very well. Mm-hmm. And so that was my first sort of social life.
Yes,
you know, going out and so on. And I mean, we'd go out eating or clubbing in those days, mm-hmm. as we did. And then you start meeting friends, you know. So
Yes.
And I mean, soon after, then I met my life partner for 48 years.
Simon
Walker, yes.
Who, God rest his soul.
Yes, who unfortunately died 6 months ago.
Yes.
So, anyway.
If you'd like to take a minute.
No, it's okay. So, anyway, we had a good 48 years. Mm. And obviously, we lived together for 48 years. We were married for 20 years because obviously civil partnership, as it was then, yes. got introduced in 2005, which
in
is when we did it.
Yes.
In the UK, because we were just leaving London in those days.
Yes.
So we did that. So anyway, so that then was my life.
You were probably one of the first couples, I think.
Well, there was a bloody long list.
Was there? Elton John was on that
yeah,
list.
Well, I think it was the first. Yes, there were loads. But we were one of the first ones, yes.
And while you were living in London at the beginning, in the 70s, and you were starting to find your feet, did you miss anything about Malta, or what did you miss about Malta? It wasn't that easy to come back and visit your parents.
No, I mean
flights, flights existed, there were flights, but they were expensive.
Exactly. I mean, firstly, until I got my permit in my passport, I didn't want to leave England because I wouldn't ever be able to get back in again.
Mm.
So that took about a year and a half until it all got sorted. But yes, it was very difficult. So, I mean, when I arrived in London, when I first went, the first thing I did is send a telegram
yes.
to my parents.
Telegram.
Eventually, even to call Malta, you had to book a call. You couldn't just
pick up the phone and
no. And then our first flat that we had, we didn't even have a phone. So I used to go to the telephone booth,
yes.
stick in, you know,
the old money. Yes, coins, yes, yes.
To make a phone call.
Indeed.
So eventually, when we did get a phone at home, I took a Polaroid picture of the phone and sent it with a letter to my parents and said, I will be standing here when I'm speaking to you.
And in your friends, the people around you, your employers in the UK, what was their impression of Malta when you'd say you're Maltese? Or what was the general impression of Malta at the time? Or did you not speak about it at all?
No,
It never came up?
No, I did speak about it. I mean, because, you know, they would tease me that I wasn't English, you mm-hmm. know, I mean, in a joking way.
Okay.
But unfortunately, the Maltese at the time, in the 70s, they were mainly sort of pimps in Soho.
Ah, the gangster element.
Yes.
From the gangs from the 50s and 60s.
Exactly. And and the prostitution and all that.
So being Maltese in London
yes.
wasn't seen in a particularly positive light.
I mean, I would...
There were gangs from other countries as well,
but
the Maltese had a bad name.
I'm saying jokingly that they would say, oh, you come from Soho sort of thing.
Okay.
But then also I didn't live too far from Soho and I would go through Soho to go to the West End. And I would make sure I wouldn't open my mouth just in case somebody would notice that I'm Maltese, just in case.
God.
Because I would hear them speak Maltese.
Oh, you'd hear people speak Maltese in Soho?
Yes. Which is now, it's completely revamped, it's completely different. Soho has become alive with amazing restaurants and bars and
yes.
art and lovely hotels.
Yes.
It was different, you know, yes. it was different then. So.
But it is a part of Maltese history in London that the Maltese gangs were most known for prostitution and strip clubs and that kind of thing, while the other gangsters focused on other types of crime, it seemed.
Could be. I sort of tried to keep away from them.
Yes.
But not all.
The few Maltese who did this.
Yes, no. Again,
it doesn't reflect on the whole country, of course.
Again, in those days, mm-hmm. if you wanted to meet Maltese, you'd go to the Brompton Oratory.
Mm-hmm.
On Brompton Road, just up from Harrods, to hear the Mass at about 10 o'clock or 10:30.
The Catholic Mass.
Yes,
okay.
That's right. And then you'd go to the Bunch of Grapes, which is the pub on the corner, And there would be all the Maltese visiting.
Uh-huh.
So you'd see the Maltese friends.
I see.
So that's what used to happen.
This bunch of grapes is very well known. I've heard this.
Yes. It's on...
Mentioned before.
Yes, just opposite the Brompton Oratory.
It was owned by a Maltese person, probably.
The answer is it's a pub. I don't know. I used to go, so you used
to
say...
it was the Maltese headquarters.
Well, like on a Sunday, if you wanted to see some Maltese, you went
there. You'd be there.
Yes. I didn't have any other Maltese... friends. I had my uncle used to live in London,
mm-hmm.
North London. So it was actually when I first went up, it was very nice to be able to go to family, although yes. I didn't know them well, and my cousins who were very, very young then. And I would spend the weekend there when I had a weekend off.
Yes.
So, and have, you know, sort of Maltese cooking, and because his wife was in Maltese as well. So that was very important for me when I first went. Because I was quite homesick, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you remember, I was just 19, left home, all of a sudden I had to take care of myself.
Yes.
Financially and everything, you know. So, and I had...
At least you had a connection to Malta.
A connection.
These people.
It took me about 6 months to find a place to live. As in, I shared, and I wasn't very good with sharing because I'm very tidy, I'm very clean, and, it's disgusting. I mean, sharing a house... with about six guys, with one bathroom and one loo, as it was in those days. I mean, people shaving in the kitchen sink and the plates are in there. It's disgusting, and I couldn't bear it. So anyway, I moved along trying to find the right place.
And in the 70s, the average man was a little bit more not so modern,
domesticated
man. There was more of the facial hair and.
So eventually, I then finished up through some connection in Artillery Mansions, which is on Victoria Street in Victoria, which was amazing because from outside the door, I got the 73 bus that took me to work.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, when I got there, I said, I've arrived. Finally, I am in London and I am happy.
But the fact that you would live in central London on a hotel receptionist wage, not receptionist, you were...
Cashier. Same thing.
Hotel cashier wage. I mean, nowadays that wouldn't happen, right? It's so much more expensive.
Yes, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, I made tips. I mean, you know, you just survive.
Yes.
And I mean, I lived in a... Now you call it a studio apartment. Then it was called a bedsit.
Bedsit, yes.
You know?
There's even songs.
So a bedsit, which I shared a bathroom with somebody else.
Ah.
But it didn't matter because I had my own
room. So the bathroom
room.
Would be on the landing?
Yes.
Outside, okay.
Yes.
And you'd share a telephone as well, probably, until you got your own.
Oh, I didn't have a telephone then.
You didn't even have a telephone in the common area?
No.
This is from what I see from 70s movies and TV series. This is
of course.
Or from what I read, because obviously
I
wasn't there.
But... No central heating, just a gas... fire.
Okay. Did you have to put coins in it?
Or? No. It was part of the rent.
Okay.
But it was a corner room, so I had a lot of light.
Ah.
And I didn't have a fridge at the beginning, so my fridge was my windowsill. So I had things on the window.
Martin, I'm talking to Martin Atsopardi, who spent 30 years living in the UK and has travelled widely as well. He is Maltese, but he has a lot of international experience, shall we say. And we're talking about Malta through his international eyes. Martin, we always play some music in the show.
Yeah.
Could you choose a song that represents your life in London, maybe, or... perhaps the period we're talking about, the 70s or the 80s or 90s, the best times of your life, maybe a song that we can include in the program and have a little break before we continue chatting about your experience. And the song that you have chosen for us to hear during this edition of Malta Through International Eyes on Campus 103.7 is by Neil Diamond.
Yes.
It's called...
I Am, I Said.
And what does it
mean? And it was the beginning... of my relationship with Simon, where I had a cassette player, which was a little thing, and the cassettes. And at the time, I think I only had Neil Diamond ones, and so I had to just play it over and over again. So,
okay.
So it was sort of became a sort of
indeed.
Song.
So let's hear I Am, I Said by Neil Diamond. Thank you.
LA is fine, the sun shines most of the time, and the feeling is laid back. Palm trees grow and rents are low, but you know, keep thinking about making my way back. Well, I'm New York City born and raised, but nowadays I'm lost between two shores. LA is fine, but it ain't home. New York's home, but it ain't mine no more. I am myself to no one there, and no one heard at all, not even the chair. I am, I cried. Did you ever read about a frog who dreamed of being a king and then became one? Well, except for the names and a few other changes, if you talk about me, the story's the same one. But I got an emptiness deep inside that I've tried, but it won't let me go. And I'm not a man who likes to swear, but I never cared for the sound of being alone. I am myself to no one there, and no one heard at all, not even the chair. I cried, I am, said I, and I am lost, and I can't even say why. I am
the choice of Montenazzo Pardi, Neil Diamond's I Am, I Said. On Campus 103.7, Minainain Baranin, Malta through International Eyes. Martin, we're in. You moved to London in 74.
Yeah.
And you're establishing yourself. You've got a good job. You work in a hotel. Eventually, you met Simon. Simon Walker, who became your life partner. Was he completely British?
Yes.
Was he aware of Malta? What did he know about Malta when you first met and you were getting to know each other?
He had heard about Malta because his uncle, during the war, mm-hmm. was stationed here.
Ah.
So that's how he knew about Malta. And then when we met in 76, he then came out in August 76 to spend... I came out for 3 weeks.
So you had been in London 2 years before you managed to come back to
exactly,
visit.
Exactly. So this was my first holiday, so I had to time with my parents. So he came out for a week and spent a week in Malta.
Yes.
And fell in love with Malta. And hence, eventually, why we eventually retired to Malta.
Which would have been in the 2000s.
Yes, we came to Malta.
But you had bought property along the way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We're sort of getting ready for that time.
Yes.
But again, we came to Malta long before we retired,
mm-hmm.
because once our sort of London life came to sort of, we decided, let's try Malta in the sort of 2003-04, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
We decided, let's try Malta. So at the time, we rented our property out in the UK, came to Malta, we had a property here, and we thought, what shall we do? So I then We both reinvented ourselves. I then went to London and studied and became a fitness instructor, personal trainer, an aerobic teacher, a masseur. I did all that, which is what I used to like doing anyway, sort of thing as my hobby, because before I was in finance. And Simon then became an English teacher. So we then had new careers.
Yes.
Not the sort of, you know, difficult careers we had before. But then, so we are enjoying Malta and enjoying the weather and had a boat, you know, that sort of thing. So that's what we did then.
When you came.
When we came back.
When you came back, yeah.
That's right. But.
Yeah. Let's go back to 76.
Yes.
So 2 years away as a youngster still, 21. It must have been quite emotional to come back and see your parents after 2 years away.
Of course.
Without internet, in those days, very difficult to make a phone call, just letters.
No, of course. I mean,
the
minute it came, obviously my parents picked me up from the airport,
yeah.
Took me home. There was a big party. All my aunties, my cousins, you know, that sort of thing. And at the time I had a nephew. It was a young nephew. Only one was born in 72 because the rest of them were born after that. So there was one. So it was a big, very family orientated, you know, lunches and dinners and going to the beach. And
you were spoiled pretty much.
Well, I mean, you know, the first, you know, I think before my father told me, what's the first meal you want? You know, sort of thing, you know, so, but that's how it was then. And so then. Eventually, I would come out to Malta at least twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
I would come in the summer.
So you'd have enough finances to be able to afford that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, because eventually, once after 5 years, after I left the hotel business, I then started, you know, I worked for a company called the Orient Express Company, Sea Containers, and I progressed quite quickly within the company.
Oh, good.
And was on a good salary and, you know, so that was that. And then eventually, after 12 years, where I knew my boss wasn't going to leave, I decided to find another job, which I did, and then I worked for Reuters in London.
Interesting.
I wasn't a journalist. I went in as a finance person because I was always, my studies and business management was all finance. So I started in the finance department, and then eventually Reuters invested quite a lot of money in me, as in training me. So I then became purchasing manager, customer services manager, logistics manager, project manager, a lot within the years I was with them.
Yeah, you made quite a success of yourself.
I mean, I took redundancy eventually because the redundancy package was a very good redundancy package. And I thought, well, time I move on. And then I came, after that redundancy, I came to Malta.
I am going to ask you about Malta in the 70s and 80s and your impressions when you'd come and visit and how you saw Malta change.
Mm-hmm.
But first I want to ask you about living in London. In the 70s, from what I read, from what I see in documentaries, London wasn't... The UK went through some bad times in the 70s, unemployment, power cuts,
when I went
recession and stuff like that. And some of the things we hear about in Malta, like power cuts or whatever, you'd get them in London as well in 3 day weeks. And then the 80s are known as the year of boom, the year of the yuppies, the year of loads of money.
Filofax.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And people investing and buying Porsches and things. Tell us a little bit about that development in London, and then we'll talk about your impressions of Malta's changes.
Okay, so when I went to London, it was they were on a 3 day week, but not in London. Remember, London is always different to the rest of the UK.
Yes.
So
But rubbish not being collected, was that something that you experienced as well?
It was, but not to the extent of out of London.
Okay.
And especially when you go north. Mm. So again, you know, I was working in a hotel that people paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, I think my salary was £23 a week.
Okay.
That was my salary. Now, a room there was about £20 a night.
Okay.
So think of it in how expensive it was.
The hotel. Very high-end.
And the hotel was full. you know.
Okay.
So that's how you figure out what was happening.
But you were a little bit insulated from the rest of the UK's major problems.
I was. Now,
you lived in a bit of a sort of London bubble.
And luckily, working in the hotel business, you got your food there. So I would get to work. If it was the morning, I'd have my breakfast and then have my lunch. And then before I'd leave, I'd go and have some, take some things to take them home with me.
Ah, okay.
So I never bothered about. So that was a really good perk with the job.
Indeed.
Okay.
Indeed.
And I mean, the staff canteen was amazing. I mean, there was all sorts of foods. I mean, probably the leftovers from the main restaurants. But anyway, it seemed posh to me anyway at the time.
Yeah.
So.
And then in the '80s.
And then by the '80s, early '80s, we bought our first apartment.
Mm-hmm.
We saved up. We both had good jobs. We both got a mortgage.
Yes.
And we invested in our first apartment. And things were on looking up. Again, Simon had a better job than me because he was working in international hotels. He was traveling a lot, you know. So, you know, and we were always sort of diligent in how much we spent to make sure that we invest in the right thing. So, you know, when friends were going to Australia and going skiing in the summer, we didn't. You know, we just have saved up because eventually we wanted to buy somewhere in Malta.
Ah.
To start off.
And a long-term plan, yes.
Yes, a sort of long-term plan. But we still enjoyed life. We traveled. In the early 80s. Going to the States for the first time, mm-hmm. going to, you know, flying to New York. And then from New York, we flew to Miami, then got a car and drove through the Keys. Down.
And then in the 90s, you know, the rise of Tony Blair, you must have seen some more changes. You lived through some very interesting decades.
Yes,
I think.
And I voted for a lot of them.
Indeed.
Because obviously there you just you immediately start, you know, you're part of the...
Yeah.
The
and you were in London when Lady Di passed away.
I was in London.
What was that like?
It was devastating because at the time I used to cycle everywhere and cycling round Buckingham Palace to see all those people and the flowers and the things was not amazing, but it was, you know, soul destroying, really. All the major things. I mean, even when they got married, I mean, you know, going to...
Oh, of course, the royal wedding in 81.
Of course, going to a friend's house, a party, you know, just to with a... He hired a big screen for us.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Having said that, we a lot of people in Malta saw it live as well.
Yes, of course.
I remember watching it on one of the few colour TVs that was allowed to be...
Was it allowed?
I think 81, some people had the colour TV, and somehow I happened to be... my family happened to know them, and we were invited because we had that issue about a certain sort of... the socialist ideals that were in place at the time, which meant that Malta had certain rules, which then changed in 87.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yes, your impressions of Malta from afar and from your twice yearly visits from the 70s right up to the time when you came back.
Again, when I would come, I'd be very influenced by my father telling me what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I didn't used to... read the Malta papers when I lived abroad. So I didn't know really what was happening.
You didn't have access to them at all?
Not really, but, you know, only reasonably recently you could look online.
Would Malta ever make the English papers at all? Would there be something about Malta?
Well, I mean, normally when it was sort of something wrong.
Something bad, yes.
bad, which nothing really comes to mind at the moment.
Maybe the 85 hijack.
Of course.
Or maybe the summit in 89, possibly, but...
Something about the bad weather. Yes, I remember that.
Yes.
So but things like
nothing really comes to mind.
Nothing really comes to mind. So then I used to come, and then I'd be catch up to date with what was happening with my brothers and their children and the schools and all that. You know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I would pick up on what was happening. But again, I was quite cocooned in what was happening because I was here on holiday. I just went to the beach, went home to see my parents, then went back to the UK, you know, so I didn't really get involved.
Yeah.
Now you are so much more exposed to things happening with social media and the news and so on,
yes.
that you get dragged in that sort of thing and conversation.
Even if you live abroad, if you work in Brussels, you can still have access to every single news portal, Maltese news portal, and know
exactly
what the latest scandal is.
I mean, again, in the early 2000s, before I came to Malta, I then subscribed and was looking at the Malta Times on a daily basis.
The early internet.
I wanted to know what was happening in Malta because I knew I was coming.
Yes.
You know, so... But then it was easier. But as I said before, when you went, you were just cut off.
Cut off.
Unless you were speaking to your family or whatever. Because I think then... And the letters would come from my parents with maybe some news of
yeah.
I mean, my father wouldn't be writing political news or what was going wrong, so he'd be talking more about the family, what
Indeed.
Was happening. You know? So,
Okay, and then in the early 2000s, you decided... You and Simon decided to come back.
In the early 2000s, we decided to, you know, shall we think of... coming to Malta with trying, and Simon had this opportunity.
Early retirement type thing?
Well, yes, but we knew we had to carry on working.
Mm-hmm.
But because, you know, we could rent out our property in the UK, we knew that we would cover some income.
Mm-hmm.
Then we came to Malta. And so that's then when we started a different life here.
Mm.
And we gave ourselves a cushion of about 7 years before we decided, are we going to go back? You know, so we never sold any property in the UK until then, because if we needed to go back, you needed your property in the UK.
Indeed. So when did you come back to Malta?
Simon came back in about 2003 and I came about 2004.
And how hard was it to adapt to Maltese life?
Hard. Very hard.
Now, this is something you have to expound upon.
Very hard. For a start, I missed my friends. Now, I know I had friends here, but it's nothing like the formative years I had there with all my close friends and group of friends. And we used to go to the theatre and go to, you know, whatever we did together. All of a sudden,
yes,
I was here. And who I thought were friends here didn't turn out to be such good friends because, you know, and also that, it's awful, that different mentality. I had a very English mentality.
Mm.
And, you know, so I struggled at the beginning. Uh-huh. While Simon didn't really struggle because he was the sort of Englishman.
Okay.
I struggled because I couldn't fit in any camp, really.
And you still faced some sort of discrimination or raised eyebrows because of your relationship as well?
Not really.
That time, things had improved?
Not really. We never really felt anything
when
we came to Malta, anything. We were very easily mixed into society, whether it was what I call straight or gay, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. It was just, that was mm-hmm. fine. I had my management skills from my previous jobs, and now I had my new skills of the fitness world. I was then employed by Synergy, the gym, as a manager there, and I was teaching all the classes and doing all that sort of thing. And that's when I was struggling with my Maltese. Because obviously, having lived abroad for 30 years...
With the language, you mean?
Yes.
Yes.
But, you know, it was, you know, baptism of fire. I had to learn it or not, mm-hmm. because, you know, you do. And I did. They'd make fun of me, you know, they'd laugh at me when I spoke Maltese.
Ma issa titkellmu normali.
Issa niskellem normali. Forse għandi accent Inglis. But, no.
And then you got involved in the theatre here.
And then, I mean, I was always... I, when I was young, I was very involved in the theatre here.
Yeah.
And then when I went to England, I obviously watched a lot of theatre. I always loved it. When I came back...
But did you do any theatre in the UK?
No.
No, okay.
No, I just watched it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew...
But you must have watched some great big names and...
Yes. I mean, I was like, you know, Michael Crawford, Sarah Brightman doing, you know, the first...
Phantom of the Opera. Oh,
you
wow.
Know,
oh,
you
wow.
know, Hermione Gingold in Little Light Music, you know, real good names.
Yes.
Obviously, because I was there and we went. When I came here, then I sort of got involved with plays. And not firstly, I was at school with Tony Bettina for Masquerade.
Mm-hmm.
We were great friends. And so, you know, I did a play with them. And then I went with them ADC and I was doing loads and loads of plays and Shakespeare. And
eventually you ended up...
And then I eventually ended
the chairman
up
of the
chairman
club,
of MADC.
Which is a historic club and it was quite a prestigious position.
I was there for 10 years as chairman.
Well done.
So I resigned because of my personal circumstances at the time. But obviously MADC has a little soft spot in my heart.
So you came back in 2004. By which year do you consider yourself to have said, okay, I'm happy now, I'm settled, Malta is my home again? Did it take 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years?
Yes, it took at least 2 years. But and then when we decided to release our property in the UK, which made sense because of, you know, highs and lows, and you didn't want to lose on property, that sort of thing, then we decided, okay, we're going to sell. So that was about 2007, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So then we felt, that's it, we're going to remain here now.
Okay.
And by then, we both had lives. I was involved in the theatre and the gym and training and doing marathons, you know, that sort of thing. And Simon was involved in all the British things, you know.
Yes, just like the St. Paul's Cathedral.
He was very much involved in the St. Paul's Cathedral. He was involved in all St. Lazarus, you know, all other...
There's quite a healthy expat community.
Yes, which unfortunately, though, is sort of dying off.
Mm-hmm.
Because now there are a lot of what I call non-Maltese people in Malta, and the British, there isn't that sort of community that there used to be before.
Indeed. Yes, the old British residents who would come here to retire in the 80s and 70s, 80s and 90s, they're now dying off. And
they're not being...
The foreign communities now, which are much larger, are from other countries.
Exactly.
Yes, it's, you know, the distance between Malta being part of the empire and today is growing, isn't it? So
I see that difference, because obviously I still have a connection with a lot of the British people that Simon was involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And I see them sort of dying off and no new ones are...
Not being replaced. Which brings me to my question. It's 2025 that we're recording this interview.
Yeah.
And now you possibly... Are you in a position where you visit London and you see it as a bit of an alien place, different, changed, or not?
I go to London. I mean, I've been...
Because you've been away from living there for about 20 years now.
Exactly.
And London is constantly changing. And sometimes you hear some British people complain about London, that it's basically you have people from other countries who have settled there and that they are the majority and not. And then, obviously, then it becomes a discussion about possible racism or immigration or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's not go into that.
No.
But as somebody who lived in London for 30 years, and then you're 20 years in Malta with the occasional visit, now you look at London. How do you see it?
I see it as my home. It's funny because I, obviously, since Simon died, I immediately went to London. And the first thing I did is go and visit all the places we lived.
Uh-huh.
Because I had to do that. And a lot of things hasn't changed. I mean, because obviously in the UK, in London, the property remains exactly the same.
Mm.
You know, so I was walking around all the areas and, you know, all that sort of nostalgia in your head saying, oh, I used to walk to work, I used to do this, I used to go to the gym here, I used to do this. And all that was that. And I keep saying to myself, I could live here again. I could just walk in and go back. But then I realized that most of my friends have left London, because when you get to a certain age, most people leave London and go to the country.
Is it because it's too fast?
I think cash in on their property and go and live in the country, mm-hmm, and pocket the profit.
I see what you mean, yes.
But also, when you are a bit older, it's maybe easier to live in the country or to live out of the country, like, as in maybe Spain or Italy or wherever, you know, uh-huh, people live abroad.
The pace of life is a bit slower.
Yes, yeah, because London, I mean, again, but I love that sort of thing, probably because I'm only doing it for a short time now. You know, you go, I mean, the Elizabeth line, which is the latest sort of, you know, tube line that they've opened,
yes,
is amazing. So, you know, I sort of used to go everywhere via it because it's...
So you're one of these people who seem to embrace the new rules, the new things that
are being introduced
in London, rather than say, oh, things were better in my time.
No, I like technology. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that now we're on a phone. I can look up everything.
Yes.
Thank God I keep up with technology and I don't run away from it. I learn from it. And that keeps me going. So in the UK, I mean, exactly, you just...
And you've always been used to having somebody whose parents were from Pakistan running the corner shop, and somebody whose parents were from Australia running this shop and working with somebody from South Africa and people from all over the world and all colors and races and creeds. You've always mixed with people like that, even in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Exactly, because in those days,
nowadays it's no different for you.
No, in those days, people from Australia used to come on a 2-year visa and work for 2 years there. Mm. So I had a lot of Australian friends, South African friends. They all did that. They all used to come to the UK.
Yes.
So we used to all work together and become friends with them.
Yes.
And now they're scattered all over the place in Canada, whatever.
Yes.
And luckily, through social media, you can still connect with them.
Do you think we've got more work to do here in Malta for the average Maltese to be a bit more maybe accepting of people whose skin color is a bit different or whose culture is a bit different? Or are we on the right track? These things take time.
But I think that it's up to the individual, really. I mean, I think, I don't know, I have never been biased against anybody, whatever color, religion, or whatever. It was never part of my upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, in those days, I say this. I remember in 73 going to Paris on holiday.
Yes.
And the thing that impressed me wasn't the Eiffel Tower, but the amount of people I saw with black skin.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we weren't exposed in those days. But
yeah, exactly.
But that impressed me, but it didn't put me off.
No.
Mm-hmm. You know, so that was my feeling. Now, unfortunately, you know, everywhere in the world, there are people who are biased and you know, are xenophobic against people from different countries.
Yes, or maybe it's a knee-jerk reaction, or maybe whatever.
Yeah.
And it happens everywhere. Yes, exactly.
Yes, it's, I mean, you know, do you want them as your neighbors? Well, I want neighbors who don't make noise and who don't make this. It doesn't matter of their skin color or so on.
Mm.
If they're going to start, you know, sacrificing their sheep in the middle of the garden, it's an issue. But, you know what I mean? So, unfortunately, it's cultural issues that can cause problems between then... You know that can happen, I think. So why people aren't so tolerant, you know? But
you're hopeful.
I am hopeful. Yes, I mean, what I say, my world in Malta doesn't come across anybody who's against anybody.
Mm-hmm,
but that's maybe I'm blinkered and I just.
And the people who surround you, none of them have any of these issues or anything.
No.
So
if they had big issues like that, they wouldn't be my friends.
That's I think that's a wonderful way to end this conversation. So it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Talking about your life journey so far, Martin Atzopardi, who spent 30 years in living in London and has traveled widely, has a connection to Gibraltar, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, but has also lived for many, many years in Malta and is Maltese. Do you say maybe half Maltese, half British?
No, I'm Maltese.
But you do feel a bit of Britishness in you.
Yes.
You are Maltese, but with some British, I don't know, culture in you.
Yeah, I mean... I laugh at English jokes. I don't laugh at Dutch jokes. And I think that's quite important when you understand the sense of humor of a country. That means that you've got it sort of in you.
Indeed. Wonderful talking to you, Martin. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
My name is Baranin Malta through International Eyes. I'm Colin Fitz. Join us next week for another edition of this program here on Campus 103.7.